This is continuing with Rod Davies on 30th August 76.
Yes, David had nearly completed a receiver, which I helped him with, and we put this on a 30-foot dish that was originally on Beachy Head as a radar detecting dish across the channel.
During the war?
During the war, yes. Lovell had caught this and brought it to Joddle a few years previously. And this turned out to be quite a useful instrument for the sort of work we were doing at that stage. In fact, it was slightly bigger than the Westerbork dish that made the first hydrogenine survey.
The Coatback one.
And we were particularly interested in the distances of the radio sources. And our main astronomical effort was towards getting the absorption spectra of the radio sources.
Okay, well, this is, of course, a very important step in the development of radio astronomy. So I'd like to pursue that further. How did this idea come up? The whole idea of absorption of optical lines, interstellar lines, was around. Was it analogous to that?
Exactly analogous to that one. There'd been several meetings at about the time I went to Joddle in which Bader and Minkowski had discussed the identification of these objects, Cassiopeia and Cygnus X, and people were wondering what their distances were. And at that stage, one didn't have a clear idea of what the radio distances to the radio stars were. Cygnus had a redshift, an optical redshift. Now, we thought that if we could get a radio redshift for Cygnus, then this would give us the opportunity of having an entirely radio method of getting the distance of any of the radio sources.
Were you thinking of that, doing that eventually?
Yes. And the other thing was that if you could measure the absorption spectrum of an object in the galaxy like Cass A, then you could get a distance. And this had been discussed either sort of openly in the sessions or amongst individuals at the meetings.
So the idea was around, you're saying?
The idea was around.
Yeah. Did anyone actually work out the physics of column densities and so forth that would be needed to detect absorption, or you just say, well, it might work, let's try it?
I think at that stage it was pretty obvious because we'd already got emission from these objects, and a temperature was assigned, a spin temperature was assigned.
Right.
So we thought we were going to get really quite strong signals from Cassiopeia and Cygnus in particular, because that was near the galactic plane. But it turned out that although Cass was easy to see, Cygnus wasn't. It was down near our noise. And we know now, of course, that because it's at 4 degrees latitude, the absorption at that sort of latitude, spiral arms outside our own spiral arm, are just very, very weak.
It seems like, from what you just said, then, that you did understand that given an emission profile, that same hydrogen would give you a much stronger absorption signal if you had a strong signal source behind.
Yes.
You understood this even before you set out on the experiment.
Yes. I think that was from a set of notes, in fact, that Van der Holst had given several years previously. Those
the
notes
Harvard,
were kicking around. Yes,
yes,
from Harvard. And a number of people there, people, I guess, like Bill Howard, a whole lot of them had actually written up those notes, and we had a set of that copy of that set of notes, which had a lot of this just worked out explicitly for us. So.
Okay, I hadn't remembered that was in there. I'll have to check. Okay.
That's my recollection anyway. It was the theoretical Bible to us at that time, because we're all pretty raw on the theoretical side, of course.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, experimentalists.
So what happens when you got your receiver working? Were there difficulties in getting a working system?
No, it just went ahead smoothly but slowly. There were only the two of us working on this, and we had no real expertise in the field. We just culled what information we could from people like Hanbury and a few of the firms around who were making lower noise mixers. Noise figure was the main problem as it is now, of course.
Yeah.
And we consulted with GEC and a number of other firms in the country to get the best mixer crystals we could get our hands on. And David was very good technically, and he was able to get this thing going in quite good time. And we did quite a number of things with that receiver. the main interest was in the absorption spectrum. And by 1956, we'd got a good set of absorption spectra, and we'd also looked at quite a lot of other regions in the sky. Self-absorption, for example, in extended clouds of hydrogen. And these gave us information on the spin temperature of the gas. The cool gas was one of the first cool clouds that were discovered. It was in the anti-center region.
Right.
These are widely known now.
Excuse me, I think we're going to have to move. So, was it a matter that this absorption line came up as soon as you had a working receiver, or...?
Yes, it was the aim of the experiment for about a year before we had the thing going, in fact. Stimulated largely by Ambry Brown, who was working on detecting sources at that stage with a big 220-foot telescope. And this was the forerunner of the Mark I telescope.
Right.
And we were really just addressing ourselves to this question. We can get cosmological redshifts in the radio, we're in a very strong position.
Did you know at all about the, I'm not quite sure on the timing, at NRL they accidentally discovered absorption. When did you learn about that?
We heard something, I think, from Hanbury, who'd been over in the States. We knew that they were working on emission lines. We didn't hear that they had got absorption until after we'd got it.
I see.
That was my recollection of the situation. Well, that was certainly the case. We didn't know about that until after we got it, because it was a real interest a bit later on when we started looking for the real redshifted stuff at 16,000 kilometers a second.
Now, I'm interested in the first paper in Nature that you you published, and can you tell me how you went about deriving a distance for these, especially Cassie, of course, grew to be a point of dispute over the next
following. That's right, that's right. Well, there one clearly got the absorption features at 0 and minus 40, as I recall, kilometers a second at minus 50. And on any rotation model, the minus 50 put you like 3 kpc away, in other words, in or beyond the Perseus arm. And this is where the controversy blew up, because Minkowski said that the distance was like 1 kiloparsec, having it out in 3 kpc.
That was based on some proper motions and radial velocities and such. Yeah.
And he thought he had a very clear cut distance for Cassé. And I wrote this stuff up. Was my thesis, or was my external examiner. He wasn't having it either.
I see.
But when I argued this one out at the court's request, it seemed to me that there was enough uncertainty both in the proper motion and in the positions. There's a big enough position scatter that one could be completely uncertain as to whether there was a significant distance determination at all.
Yeah, from the optical methods.
From the optical methods. Well, I wasn't a specialist in any sense at all.
Well, that's very interesting about Oort, because of course he is the founder of the whole galactic structure method and all. And so what did he think was wrong with yours?
He felt that the absorption was okay at the 40 kilometers, minus 40 kilometers a second. He thought that one should really look into the question as to why Minkowski was wrong, rather than us. But I had to justify why Minkowski was wrong, at least why.
I got you wrong then. You said what you said then is that Oort went along with you. He basically believed the radio distance more than the optical. I thought I heard the other.
No, I think he was more concerned that I should question Minkowski and what were the reasons that I did. In my thesis, I just more or less dismissed the optical as being really extremely uncertain. And he questioned my dismissal of that.
He said you can't do it.
You can't dismiss a man like Minkowski.
I see.
But you ought to talk to Martin Schmidt about this one. He's got lovely stories about Bader and Minkowski, sort of arguing this between themselves.
Well, I have talked to Martin Schmidt, but I don't think that I talked to him about this. Because, of course, he hasn't been directly involved in it.
No. Well, stories are stories. I'm not sure.
podcast. Well, I'm always interested in anecdotes if there's
they like nice them. Anecdotes.
Yeah, they like enough to see. And what was the final resolution of this distance problem?
About 2 years later, Minkowski redid the measurements and found indeed they did fit something like 3.5 kpc distance for the Cassé supernova remnant.
Right.
Just in Perseus arm, presumably. I think that's where we still think it is.
You might be interested. Ed McLean has shown me a letter that Bada sent him, essentially apologizing for being so vehement over the previous few years, saying that you were right, and here's why we went wrong. Well, let's see. Here's an article in Monthly Notices in 54. I guess this must have been based on your Australian work again, talking about correlation with flares of radio bursts and such, but it's just only by...
Yes, that was a big statistical survey. Yes, this is the work that I...
So you were continuing with your solo work even while you were at Jodrell?
No, this was published...
54.
...from the Radio Physics Division.
I see.
I don't think, apart from maybe some corrections in proof or something, but that was submitted from CSIR, I would think.
Okay.
Because I left in 53, around about September. And I think it had all been accepted by that stage. I don't recall exactly.
Okay, well, we talked about CAS. Now, what was the conclusion about Cygnus, based on the torsion?
Cygnus that was outside the galaxy, and that's all we could say.
Could
there was absorption right in the zero velocity features and in the minus 100 kilometers per second feature, I guess. That was that.
And I notice also a paper here in Nature in 55 in which you derived a distance for Sagittarius A.
That's
and
right.
Can you tell me about that?
In that one, we looked at the absorption integral, the amount of hydrogen in the total absorption, and compared that with the emission that was known from our own arm and all the other arms between us and the galactic center. And putting in a value for the kinetic temperature that was generally accepted at that stage, it looked as though one got an integral that corresponded to all the absorption occurring out into the Sagittarius arm. So they concluded there that the thing was, I think, in the Sagittarius arm and not in the galactic center.
In other words,
got it wrong.
It would have to be between the Sagittarius arm and the next arm towards the center.
That's right, yes.
And
we assume there were a number of such arms between us and the center.
There's an assumption, really.
Well, the Cotebike survey had shown the existence of the next arm in. We thought it was in front of that. I mean, you go
between
the Sagittarius arm. Norma Scutum arm, they called it, I think, at that stage.
Yeah.
And we reckon this sorted in front of Norma Scutum. That wasn't a dynamic method, that was just a line integral method, which is, we now know, because of the big variation in optical depth in clouds depending upon their temperature, is a pretty hairy method.
Right, well, in fact, in your original Nature article, here's a Xerox of it, you were using a combination of the two methods, aren't you? Because you go through what today seems a bit of a convoluted way of talking about the expected amount of absorption and the observed ratio expected to observed and therefore you come up with a 0.28 and 0.16 and the one is let's see. Oh, I'm sorry, this is one arm, this is the other arm. For Cygnus, it's clear that you're getting 6/10 of what you want, so that's close enough to all of what you want, and then you're getting 3/10 for the second one, and therefore it's likely that's all right. Cassiopeia, I'm holding out. Have to look at this.
I think in the case of Cass,
Oh, that's right. Here it is. In order to establish the distance of the radio stars from these results, it is necessary to know the total absorption which will be suffered by the 20th century radiation if you completely traverse the gas in the spiral arms. And that's what I find hard to understand. Why don't you just take the actual presence of absorption as enough indicator that it must be behind? Instead, you're trying to...
This is with a very simple-minded view of what spiral arms were like. In those days, we thought of arms as being uniform tubes of gas. And if something was behind it, you'd get as much, you'd get absorption from everything that you saw in emission. There's no clumpy model at that stage.
I see. So
they were just uniform tubes. And so, a priori, you thought, you're going to see everything in absorption that you saw in emission.
So in order to make this a good argument, it had to agree not only in the presence of the absorption, but also the amount of absorption.
That's right. No.
And I also have a note here, which I'd forgotten about, that you got a much lower amount of absorption than the people at NRL did, for instance, because of your broad filter.
I guess the integral would have been the same, but the peak.
Well, this is what you're using, I think, is the peak amount of absorption here.
Mm.
The local arm feature is 4 kilometers a second wide, Perseus is 15.
Yes.
And your things were...
we had 30 or 40 kc bandwidth then, must have been 10 at least kilometers a second.
I don't see it right now, but it was somewhat more than this, yeah. Okay, let's
move. That's a test of the memory, if you ask me what I wrote in the paper, whatever it was, 22 years ago.
Oh, yes, I
got some of it right the second time around.
I'm fully aware of that. Right? Now, you must have probably been at the Jodrell Bank Symposium in 55.
That's right.
On radio astronomy. That and the Paris Symposium are two rather interesting meetings to me in terms of the last big meetings only on radio astronomy. Do you have any impressions of sort of the state of the art at that time that came out of that meeting?
I remember the Jodrell Bank Symposium, the great excitements at the time were the optical radio correlations, the Cygnus, Cassiopeia, or the identification of Bader and Minkowski. I think they were the center of interest as far as the radio astronomers were concerned, at least those who were working in the field that we were at Jodrell Bank. On the Cambridge side, I've just lost the timing. I'm not sure.
Well, they gave the 2C results. The 2C was published in 55.
It was 2C, right. That was well received, as far as I remember. I mean, there was no criticism at that stage. They had phantom sources in their lists. I think that really didn't occur until Mills had made some progress in the South, and big controversies blew up. Then at the Berkeley meeting was where they stand up set to one another.
Right.
Now at that stage it was all accepted in face value.
So there wasn't so much controversy at that
time? No. Yeah, I don't remember it at all. Yes, I don't remember any controversy.
Yeah. Well, while I'm going along this line, what about the Paris Symposium in 58? How does that strikes you as outstanding at that meeting?
I find these two almost indistinguishable from one another in my mind now, without going back to the proceedings. At that stage, let me just say something about the topics that we're involved with. One of these was the absorption in Cygnus A, which maybe you want to talk about a little bit later, whether there's a big redshift absorption.
Right.
We were very much involved in that at the time.
Did you report on that? Maybe you did.
I'm not sure it was then or after that period.
At the Paris Symposium, you talked about H1 associated with local early type stars.
Yes.
And
that was the Gould belt system.
Yeah.
Yes. That's right. 58 was before the Mark 1 was fully operational at 21 centimeters, so we hadn't done the absorption experiment at that stage.
But I'll come back to these specific things.
Yes,
but what about the flavor of the Paris meeting? It seems to me like this is sort of the last time that one could define radio astronomy as a subject of a meeting.
Yes, yes. I think there, what I remember was you were kind of interested in everything that was going on. You got yourself involved in what was happening in solar physics, and you tried to keep up to that stage, I remember.
Yeah.
Just in case there was something that was relevant to your own field, or something that you could observe yourself with your instruments.
Yeah.
But I think it was about that time I said, well, solar physics is something of the past as far as I'm concerned, although up to having done it in Sydney, but not having done very much of it. No solar work at John Bull Banker, nevertheless one kept it in mind as a possible avenue of research if something turned up that could be done, say, with the big telescopes.
Yeah.
At that stage, I said, well, I can't keep up with all of radio astronomy, and left it.
So you couldn't keep up with the entire field. However, you made an interesting comment to me that even though that's true, you still apparently don't feel confined to one field, but rather to whatever can be done with the instruments you have at hand.
Yes. But this can happen within sort of related fields. For example, for quite a while I was involved in doing work on planets, just because we had a good receiver that we could use for total power work or polarization work. We're interested in the polarization of the emission from planets, particularly the search for any synchrotron emission after Jupiter had been identified as a supernova, as a synchrotron source. We're then interested to see whether Mars and Saturn were synchrotron sources. And we made quite a few measurements there in the planetary field, just because we had the equipment that could do it.
Yeah.
And physics wasn't too far involved from what we're involved in extragalactic sources. That really has continued much in the same way up to the present day within the group at John Bull Banker that I'm involved with, perhaps not so much in the others, where we've worked in galactic structure, interstellar medium, work in external galaxies, and work on magnetic fields and the Zeeman effect, for example. It tends to be a wide range of measurements, mainly involving use of hydrogen. Use the neutral hydrogen techniques to investigate quite a range of problems.
Okay, just to finish off the meetings business, the 61 IAU meeting, you mentioned that Mills and Rao would really at each other even more than the Paris Symposium. Someone else mentioned that to me this morning, and I was surprised. I thought the Paris Symposium was the peak of it, the peak of the controversy of the liability of 2C.
Yes.
That had been established by that time. What was the real nature of the argument in Berkeley?
It was log n, log s. The slope of log n, log s was the real problem there. And Mills was arguing that Cambridge had missed a lot of extended sources. I think they got to the stage where both sides having statistics they were reasonably happy with. I'm not sure, the Berkeley meeting they had the 3C catalogue out.
Yes,
I see. Well, I think Cambridge felt that they'd been pulled over the coals over 2C, that they'd been very careful with 3C and had got everything right. But Mills were saying no, that they'd missed a lot of the extended sources. And equally, Cambridge had said, well, Mills has manufactured sources from the fluctuations in the background of the extended beam. And this is what the basis of the controversy. Each stuck to their own statistics. They're looking at log n, log s. Had moved, I think, into a cosmological argument, whereas 2C scarcely had got that far. It was much more hinged on the discussion, I think, at the Berkeley meeting.
Well, that's true, that 2C was not only cosmological, but there was the whole technique business, but there was a lot of cosmology mixed in. I mean, maybe not so much Mills versus Rao, but Hoyle versus Rao, of course.
That's right, yes. As to whether the slope was different from 1.5, right. Was it? Important argument.
I don't quite see the publication on the looking for the high redshift absorption in Sydney Say, but can you tell me about that experiment? When was that done?
69. It would have been done after the telescope was complete.
Oh yes, 68, 50, Davies and Jennison, 59, non-confirmation of Lilly and McLean.
That's right.
Cygnus A.
Yes. Well, they'd made this measurement and it claimed an absorption. I remember Lovell coming around, jumping up and down, saying, "Well, why hadn't you blokes observed this thing?" And we sort of gave the reasons why we thought it was highly unlikely to get any absorption. But then we had a go at this, but realizing there was another set of numbers you could get out, and that's the intergalactic density. If you could actually measure the trough, the redshift of gas between us and Cygnus, so we were careful getting the local absorption as well as the end of the trough of the down at 16,000 meters a second. And we were able to use the Mark 1, of course, which gives a lot more sensitivity than Lilly McLean were able to use at that time. And didn't find a thing down there. And we were able to show pretty convincingly, I think, that there was no redshift absorption in Cygnus A itself. But in the meantime, and the interesting question of the intergalactic medium had come up. And George Field had made a measurement with the Harbin dish.
Right.
And he'd set some limits on that. And then we realised with a stronger continuum source, we could get much lower limits than he was able to get. So we did some quite careful measurements of the intergalactic density as well, which is described in the paper in Monthly Notice with Genus. So there'll be a...
Is that 61, perhaps? I don't seem to see it.
It may be.
Yeah,
may
have I've only got through 60 time. Here.
Righto. That could have come out just a little bit later. Yes. And I think soon after we'd published that, Lilly and McLean admitted that they thought they'd got interference in their band. I'm not sure that they ever published that statement.
It was in Scientific American, actually. They
I see.
In an article that right. said that we were wrong.
No, they admitted it quite openly and so on.
But it looked quite believable, though, when you, as published.
Yes,
you had
yes.
no doubts as to its reliability.
And George Field made another point, and I think this is all true, that you don't expect much absorption in these sources because the continuum flux is so high that it pushes the ground state hydrogen atom, the upper of the two hyperfine states, and it won't absorb in that state. It's been the ground state to absorb. So you've got to get a long way outside of the galaxy before, you know, a strong radio galaxy before you'll ever get absorption.
He made that point at that time? I mean...
I'm not sure exactly when this occurred.
I can check it.
You can check that.
Now, here I see something you referred to already. At a symposium at Cambridge, Massachusetts in 57, you talked about that the H1 was cooler in some regions, and I guess that was referring to your anti-center club.
That's right.
Well, was that something new at that time?
Dave Heeshan had got something similar, and I think it was mentioned in that meeting within a year or so, and I've forgotten, we were looking at quite independent things. He was looking at the galactic center. He found a very narrow feature in the galactic center. In fact, it turned out to be about 30 degrees across, in fact. And he found this low temperature there, and this independent one that I'd got sort of added up to the story between the two that made you realize it was this cold component of the interstellar medium. Being colder than the canonical 120 degrees, right. I think the Dutch people have come up with.
Right. It's fair to say, I think, that the Dutch model was really one of uniform density and temperature, except for the fact of the spiral structure. And once you were within an arm, it was all sort of uniform.
That's right. But I think Kahn, at about that time, was talking about the harmonic mean temperature,
that's right.
which is genuinely what you are seeing. And I think it wasn't a surprise that one was coming up with these lower temperatures. And talk about the cooling mechanisms and so on, so one was obviously going to get hot and cold clouds.
But was anyone looking for hot clouds at this time?
And difficult to observe, that's the trouble.
Well,
I think you're aware of that. And I think the temperatures in the absorption spectra were only discussed in any detail later, in the early 1960s, outside the period you're talking about, where the Skewer and Shooter at John Bull Bank were at the time. We've got all these absorption features on the strong radio sources, and they went through and analysed this data.
Yeah, Bill Shooter just told me about that
That's right.
A couple of days ago. And also Rick Barry Clark about the same time.
Yes, yes, it got data from it. Later, given the absorption of that part.
Now, it's interesting that. What was the nature of this symposium in Cambridge, Mass. In 57? I'm not sure I know which.
It's published in Reviews of Modern Physics, and it was run by R.N. Thomas.
Yes, I know.
He got a lot of theoretical people together and some observers.
I didn't know.
It was very stimulating. I mean, that helped me a tremendous amount, that particular meeting, because the theoretical people were there as well, discussing things in a way that we could understand. I think Thomas made sure that the theoretical and observational people were getting to know one another's language.
Which doesn't happen.
Even today. It was a small enough meeting to be very stimulating as far as the distiller medium was concerned.
Mm-hmm. What did you learn specifically?
Well, I think Kahn, for example, talked about his collision model for distiller clouds, the whole process of cooling in clouds, the sort of a stochastic nature of the intercloud medium came up. People were trying to get together sort of the optical and the radio absorption data. So we went away with quite a lot of stuff we could then apply directly to our observations.
Now during this time, it seems like you're doing several H1 projects that are related, one might say, to optical astronomy. For instance, you're looking in dense dust clouds, you're looking at Gold's Belt. There's another example I thought I saw. And this is perhaps more optically oriented than any radio astronomers.
It isn't, yes.
What was the reason for this?
I think it was a sort of a realization very early on that we were dealing with the same thing. You'll also notice, and we haven't talked about this very much yet, and that's the Gould Belt system. And this is really what signaled to me that we had data that was complementary to the optical stuff. The Gould Belt region, which is well known in terms of the H2 region, the younger stars and the dust, is just the very same region where we get an excess of neutral hydrogen. And that was a case where I got all the optical data out and did what I could to correlate the two. And this immediately, I think, sort of thrust itself in my mind from then on that we really were very much doing the work in parallel with the optical people. It's only by putting the two lots of data together we made any sense of it.
What was your reasoning that Gould's Belt should have H1 also?
Well, it worked the other way around. Having found the H1, one went back
and
saw
the way it happened.
We found this H1 well away from the galactic plane.
I see.
This was using a 30-foot dish of Jodrell, and I did a complete sky survey, in fact. Having finished the absorption exercise, we had a nice system going, and I just surveyed the whole sky at 21 centimeters. The Dutch had done the galactic plane, but what I did was then look at intermediate latitudes. And at about the same time, people at DTM made a similar survey, Telfer and company, and they got complementary to ours in one way or another. They didn't have the temperature resolution or the frequency resolution. And my stuff clearly showed the Gould Belt system having a whole sky, and published a whole sky map. Then that was sort of obviously a part of the Gould Belt system.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at the stars, the general asymmetry of the whole thing, 20 degrees off the plane, you see.
Yeah.
Hydrogen is very, very strong in the Gould Belt region, but essentially undetectable at similar latitudes elsewhere. It's a major asymmetry. And a number of other features too that came out of the All Sky thing. The Cepheus region is a similar thing to the Gould Belt system, and Cygnus X also. Cygnus X was again one of the other studies, and I did some continuum work to make it up into a sort of a whole study.
Were you working with any specific optical astronomers, or just sort of reading books?
No, just reading books. But talking a lot to them. I mean, at that stage, I sort of made contacts at the Harvard meeting. And remember, at that time, Bock was running the Harvard Radio Astronomy Group, being an optical person doing radio astronomy. It seemed back to front to most radio astronomers. Good luck to him, I didn't expect him to get very far with it. But in fact, he stimulated within his own group, of course, the close tie-up between optical and radio.
That's right.
And he also did the same thing in me, in fact, so I owe him quite a lot in that respect. something that has stimulated me as a result of that particular meeting and my good dog exercise.
What about the fact that the major amount of H1 work had, of course, been done by the Dutch by the time that you were doing your stuff, and they were, of course, or it all came out of an optical observatory. It was all very much associated with classical astronomy. So was that, you think, orienting you in that way at all?
That also is another reason why one sort of kept an eye on the optical side, because they were people that worked in that field themselves, and galactic structure up to them, being the problems of optical people. So on the hydrogen line side, I think this was a natural way to go, to keep in close with the optical work. Whereas extragalactic radio source work, there was nothing optical to tie in with anyway,
right,
by and large.
Right.
So the radio astronomers there tend to be estranged from the rest of the astronomical community, but the H1 observers weren't. Except perhaps the early days, people like Christensen and so on were doing their own thing, and Ewan, they were essentially outside the optical fraternity, but Ford and company were very much part of that fraternity.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting comment. You probably knew, you probably were a correspondent in this 21 centimeter newsletter that went around for a couple of years. Did you get that at that time?
I got it, but I don't know. It only existed for a short time
after we
got going.
Yeah, yes. 52 to 54 or something. But it seems to me that this is tremendous evidence of cooperation amongst the few observatories working at it. I mean, it's impossible to imagine a radio source newsletter, people giving their results before publication.
That's right, yes. That particular issue, though, is a question of personalities in different countries, I think.
You think it could have just...
It's a different thing, probably, because of the subject. The optical people were used to talking to one another. So the radio people tend to be a lot of individualists who come out of the war situation are going to do their own thing or bust, almost.
Yeah.
I don't know how you interpret all that.
But it's a very different philosophy. There's no doubt about it.
They would tend to be, by and large, much more aggressive than their optical counterparts.
Well, let's see. Now, I see a publication in 57 in Australian Journal of Physics, Christensen, Warburton, and Davies, on the slowly varying component and so forth. Did you go back to Australia? Or?
No. What had happened was that we had done some work together just before I left. Before I left, I went, got out of Piddington's domain, where we were doing statistical survey, not statistical analysis of data. And then I got myself involved much more in observational work. Well, at Horsey's instigation, really, and my own feeling that I didn't want to get involved only in the interpretation, I wanted to get involved in learning about the equipment, getting results of my own. And I worked with Christensen and Warburton with their 32-element interferometer. There were 16 elements at that stage, though, building it up to 32 about the time I left. And I had been working on a spectrohelioscope that we had, observing each day the brightness of the H-alpha regions on the sun.
I see.
It was while doing that I discovered the H-alpha emission was correlated with the radio bright spots that they were getting from across the dam. I was on the other side of the Pottsville Dam with this thing dropping them, of course, at the same time that
I see.
I was responsible for the H-alpha work. And that's where we spotted this correlation between the radio hot spots. And before anything like a sunspot appeared, you'd get an H-alpha plage appearing there. And following that up, I then measured the positions of these H-alpha plages, and we correlated those with the position of the continuum emission, what was the progress across the sun, and by looking at the rate of movement, you could actually assess a height for the stuff. So we're able to get some information on the heights and sizes of the radio emitting regions tied to the optical measure. So that was at 67 paper.
57.
57 paper as a result of the work that was started before I left in 53. They did a bit more work after I'd left, extending the whole picture through a period of time. The essential conclusions were worked out before I left.
Okay, just trying to touch upon these others. I see Davies and Jennison, 1960, on using Mark 1 for observations of Sagittarius A, Cygnus X, and the Moon. This seems to fall on the classification as an observatory. What you were saying, you've got the dish and you just measure everything
inside. Exactly that, yes. They're really the first observations with the Mark 1. We just got our receiver on there.
Well, this was 60. Was it then?
So we got going in 59.
Oh, I see. So this may have been early 60, yeah.
Yes. Things get published.
Right.
You made the observation.
Now, here's one with Henry Brown and Hazard on a spur at about 30 degrees longitude.
Right. That's an interesting one, yes. They had been working on this for ages, the distribution of the continuum emission around the galaxy. And they'd been thinking more in terms of this being the radiation from the spiral arms. One of the spiral arms near the edge, at least L equals 30 being near the edge of one of the spiral arms, and they had a model which they're thinking about this. And I'd been, well, we had a lot of discussions over coffee and tea, tend to be very open and free discussions that we had. And I had been thinking more about supernovae for some reason or other, and when they got talking about this, it seemed to me that this was a possible supernova type explanation.
A very nearby one.
A very nearby one. And we worked on this together and developed this idea. Although I wasn't observed in any of the observations.
I see.
I came in because it was one of these topics that had been raised in discussion, and we'd worked out the explanation together and pushed ahead with this supernova explanation of the spur rather than geometries of the synchrotron emission.
What about this one in the Jodrell Bank Annals 58 about the polarization of the crab? Was that done with the 30-foot dish, I guess?
That was done with the 30-foot dish. About the time that what I remember, Gart Westerhout had observed something around about that time.
Yes.
And we had a polarimeter going. We thought this was a good opportunity to see if we could check this. And we pushed quite down on the limits, and I think they were comparable to what he got.
Less than 2.5%, 2.75%.
What I remember now, something like 1.6. Yes, so we never observed any significant polarization. I've forgotten now just how significant that was in those days.
I'm not sure either. But it seems like from this abstract that you were pretty clear how that could come about, that it would be much less than the optical polarization.
That's right. Presumably at that stage someone observed at shorter wavelengths but higher percentage polarization.
Well,
the optical had been observed. That's right. That's right.
But it was also 50%. Just about precisely this time, but you probably didn't know about it, the NRL that Mayer and company picked up. At 3 centimeters, I think it was.
Right,
yes,
before we knew about the case.
Well, the final thing I see here on specific projects is the Zeeman study. Could you tell me about that experiment?
Well, once we've done our observations on Cygnus, we realized that we had a dish at 21 centimeters gave us good efficiency compared with smaller dishes, but it had bad side loads. The old Mark 1 had something like 80% of its energy in a plateau around the main beam.
I see.
So I knew immediately that we weren't going to be spending any time mapping our own galaxy, because essentially you ended up with a half degree beam rather than a quarter of a degree beam, which is where all that energy was. It was just incredibly difficult to interpret it. So I then looked around at significant experiments we could do with where we could work on point sources, small angular diameter objects.
Was this due to just surface irregularities?
Surface irregularities in the Mark 1. It was originally designed as a 1 meter dish, and after the 21 centimeter line had been discovered from hydrogen, we thought it was worth putting a uniform sheet surface on it, so that we could at least use the 21 centimeters, no matter what its gain was. So we got quite a high gain, something like 5 flux units per degree, enough to be able to do some hydrogen work, a lot of hydrogen work, from Cygnus absorption, Cass absorption, and so on. In fact, all those early programs, the things you could do, and